The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello again, this is Randall Rickman from Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. This edition is a double issue, so it's dated June 7th, 2019, and also June 14, 2019. So we'll try to squeeze 2 weeks' worth into one 58-minute segment. On the cover, the story is The Equalizer. Alex Morgan leads the favored U.S. team at the World Cup, but her most important goal is off the field, by Sean Gregory. We go right to the beginning of the magazine, and we come to the For the Record page, and it's a one-page compendium of tiny news items, each one illustrated by a two-color drawing or a caption in bold or a combination of the two. In the upper right corner is a story illustrated by the numerary statistic 3,495. Caption explains, number of votes both candidates earned in the election for mayor of Aracel, the Philippines. Sue Cudillo ended up defeating incumbent Noel Bereneo in a coin toss on May 17th. And in addition to the statistic in bright red, 3,495, there's also a two-color drawing of a hand flipping a coin, the hand with red fingernails. In the right margin of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Donald Trump, U.S. President, responding to May 20th, responding on May 20th to the New York Times' latest investigation of the dealings with, of his dealings with Deutsche Bank. The quotation from Donald Trump, U.S. President, quote, when you don't need or want money, you don't need or want banks, unquote. Caption goes on to say, he denied the report that he had been unable to get loans from other banks. In the lower portion of the page is a story illustrated by a headline in all caps, black and bold, from Sabrina Fulton, mother of Trayvon Martin, announcing on May 20th that she's running for Miami-Dade County Commissioner. And a quotation from Sabrina Fulton, mother of Trayvon Martin, quote, when my son got shot down, I stood up, unquote. Caption goes on to say, her son's 2012 death helped launch the Black Lives Matter movement. Running along the bottom right of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Kami Rita, Nepalese mountain guide who climbed Mount Everest twice in 1 week on May 15th and May 21st. And the quotation from Nepalese mountain guide Kami Rita in red, quote, I actually never knew that you could make a record. Had I known, I would have made a lot more summits earlier, unquote. Caption goes on to explain, the 49-year-old Sherpa's 24 ascents set a record for most successful climbs of the peak. Mount Everest, 24 ascents, Kami Rita. In the lower left corner of the page is a story illustrated by the monetary amount, $75. Caption explains, cost of a cup of what's being called the world's most expensive coffee, $75. California-based Klatch Coffee, the only North American chain to sell the rare brew called Elida Geisha Natural 803, has already sold out of it, $75. That item also accompanied by a drawing, a two-color drawing of a cup of coffee. The cup is red, and the steam coming from the top of the coffee is forming a steamy dollar sign. In the middle left margin of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Vladimir Zelensky, Ukraine's new president, after being sworn in on May 21st. The quotation from Ukraine's new president, Vladimir Zelensky, quote, "I really do not want my pictures in your offices, for the president is not an icon, an idol, or a portrait," unquote. Caption goes on to say, the 41-year-old, formerly a TV comedian, also called for snap parliamentary elections. In the upper left corner of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Robert F. Smith, billionaire CEO of Vista Equity Partners, announcing during his May 19th commencement speech at Morehouse College that he will pay off millions in debt for graduating seniors. And a quotation from billionaire Robert F. Smith, quote, "This is my class, 2019, and my family is making a grant to eliminate their student loans," unquote. In the right middle of the page is the feature within a feature, Bad Week, Good Week. At Bad Week, all beef hot dogs. Vienna Beef recalls over 2,000 pounds of skinless beef frankfurters for possible metal contamination. Under Good Week, meatless sausage. Little Caesars is testing a vegetarian sausage pizza topping made by Impossible Burger. In the center of the page is a story illustrated by the statistic in bright red, 19.3 million. Caption explains, number of viewers across all platforms who tuned in to watch the Game of Thrones finale on May 19th, setting a record for HBO, 19.3 million. That in red. Going forward, we are now in the major opening section called The Brief. And the opening section of The Brief is called Opener. The subsection here is the feature News Ticker, compendium of three news items stacked one on top of the other. Top item, Hungary accused of refugee abuse. The Council of Europe, a human rights agency, has found that asylum seekers in Hungary face widespread abuse, including being denied food. The May 21st report, which Hungary disputes, says the anti-migrant stance of Viktor Orban's nationalist government has, quote, undermined, unquote, refugee protections. Middle item, Trump's EPA changes pollution math. The Environmental Protection Agency plans to change how it calculates the risks of air pollution, the New York Times reported on May 20th. The new model lowers the number of premature deaths that can be linked to pollution and would likely allow the Trump administration to defend easing regulations. Bottom item, Swiss voters back gun control. Switzerland will tighten its gun laws after 64% of voters backed tougher restrictions on automatic and semi-automatic weapons in a May 19th referendum. The changes will bring the non-EU nation, in which nearly 48% of households own a gun, in line with EU regulations adopted by the bloc after the 2015 Paris terrorist attacks. Going forward, still in The Brief, but we were now at health. And the headline is, A Gender Gap No One Wants to Close, by Jamie Ducharme. For decades, suicide prevention experts have been stumped by a phenomenon known as the gender paradox. Though girls report contemplating suicide more often than boys, and made more attempts, boys die by suicide far more regularly. But new data draws from four decades of public records and published in JAMA Network Open suggests this gender gap is closing. It's, quote, alarming, unquote, says study author Donna Ruch, a researcher at Nationwide Children's Hospital in Ohio. Quote, on top of the fact that females are thinking about suicide more and attempting suicide more, now they're actually completing suicide, unquote. Starting in 2017, suicide rates for girls ages 10 to 14 began increasing by 13% annually, compared with 7% for boys, according to the new study. For teens 15 to 19, the average annual increases were 8% for girls and 3.5% for boys. As a result, the gap between male and female suicide rates has lessened considerably, Ruch says. In 1975, boys 10 to 14 died by suicide 314% more often than girls in that age range. By 2016, that number fell to 180%. For the 15 to 19 age group, the gap between boys and girls narrowed from 415% to 331%. Adults can help kids of any gender by talking to them about suicide and mental health. But Ruch says we need better gender-specific suicide prevention strategies. For example, girls and young women are more likely to be diagnosed with depression and anxiety, while boys are more likely to display conduct or aggressive behavior disorders. Approaches that home in on these risk factors, Ruch says, could help stymie the suicide trend across all demographics. Article by Jamie Ducharme. In the right margin of the page is a sidebar feature called You Asked. And here, you asked, is your sunscreen safe? Article by Alice Park, who writes, researchers at the Food and Drug Administration recently found that four of the most common active ingredients in sunscreens can be absorbed through the skin and appear in the blood. The health impacts are unclear, but it's concerning enough that the agency has requested more research on the effects of sunscreen ingredients. The FDA is finalizing new regulations for evaluating the safety of sunscreens, and it found that only two ingredients, zinc oxide and titanium dioxide, are generally safe and effective. Two others, PABA or PABA, and trolamine salicylate have been linked to adverse health effects and are unsafe. I'll repeat that for clarity. Two others, PABA or PABA, and trolamine salicylate have been linked to adverse health effects and are unsafe, while 12 have not been studied enough for the agency to say anything about their safety. The FDA is expected to request more studies on these 12 ingredients, but until its final report is submitted later this year, the Environmental Working Group's annual list of best sunscreens can be useful in sunscreen shopping. It relies on similar criteria as the FDA. The Environmental Working Group's annual list of best sunscreens. Reader apologizes for the multiple stumbles in that reading. Moving ahead, and we are now at the sidebar feature called Short Reads. Time explains highlights from stories on time.com/ideas. Again, there are three samples, loaded top to bottom. Top item, what won't save Roe? when it comes to continuing abortion access in America, quote, anyone grasping for optimism is mistaken, unquote, writes Catherine Colbert and Linda J. Wharton, who were co-counsels on the 1992 Supreme Court case Planned Parenthood v. Casey. They urge pro-choice voters, quote, to do more than vent your alarm on social media, unquote. Second excerpt, A Tragedy's Second Act. Sri Lankan novelist Anuk Adrakazagam fears that the Easter Sunday killings, if overtaken by a global narrative rooted in Islamophobia, will help the nation's majority population evade its own history of violence. He writes, quote, it is easier sometimes to follow a script, after all, even when it comes at the cost of peace, unquote. Bottom item, making parenting fair. While reporting for her recent book, All the Rage, psychologist Darcy Lockman found that many couples fall into a trap that often results in working women continuing to do far more of the child care than their husbands. They tell themselves, quote, we'll fix it later, unquote. Those excerpts are samples from time.com/ideas. Sharing the page is the feature from the opener called The View. And this item is by David French. The headline is Blundering Toward War. Time notes, French is a Time columnist, lawyer, and senior fellow at the National Review Institute. While the public is tracking the fact that tensions with Iran are rising, it does not know precisely why. On May 5th, National Security Advisor John Bolton announced that the administration had ordered a carrier strike group to the Persian Gulf region, allegedly in response to unspecified Iranian threats. On May 13th, the New York Times reported that the White House was reviewing updated military plans that could send a total of 120,000 troops to the Middle East, which would near the total at the height of the Iraq War. Then on May 15th, the State Department ordered all, quote, non-emergency, unquote, personnel out of Iraq. This is happening in the aftermath of the administration's 2018 decision to pull out of the Iran nuclear deal and later to designate Iran's Revolutionary Guards Corps a terrorist organization. On May 21, the administration finally briefed Congress on the alleged nature of the Iranian threats. Yet the briefing left lawmakers divided. While Republicans Lindsey Graham called the intelligence a, quote, game changer, unquote, key Democrats were unimpressed. The public, meanwhile, remains largely in the dark. It's important to be clear about the gravity of the situation. War with Iran would represent a military challenge far more substantial than toppling the Taliban or Saddam Hussein. Iran's military is intact. It has substantial missile assets and considerable ability to attack American forces directly and through proxy forces throughout the Middle East and perhaps well beyond. I served in Iraq during the surge, deployed close to the Iranian border. My squadron, sadly, experienced firsthand the lethality of Iranian militias. American forces struggle to suppress these forces throughout the Iraq conflict, and they represent but one component of the overall Iranian threat. The president, meanwhile, is mercurial, even in his national security pronouncements. While Trump disputed the Times report on May 19th, he both tweeted, quote, if Iran wants to fight, that will be the official end of Iran, unquote, and said in a taped Fox News interview, unquote. I'm not somebody that wants to go into war, unquote. This is characteristic. Trump often moved from hawk to dove and from dove to hawk. Just look at his shifting stances on Syria and North Korea. After the Mueller report and a May 15th story by The Atlantic, both depicted a White House where aides slow walk or disobey Trump's orders, it is also worth wondering who is rattling the saber. Bolton's hostility against Iran is longstanding. He has a command of history and the facts that the president lacks. And tactical decisions made short of war can ratchet up tensions more than the president understands. I am not arguing that Trump's advisers would dare initiate outright hostilities without his approval. But a nation cannot properly prepare for serious conflict without assurance that the commander-in-chief is actually in command. In the aftermath of the intelligence failures in Iraq, Americans should have a healthy skepticism of military action justified by intelligence reports that leave Congress profoundly divided. And, given Trump's fundamental dishonesty and alarming ignorance, Americans should have zero assurance that their president or his administration is accurately describing the nature of the Iranian threat. While Americans deployed abroad have the inherent right of self-defense, the U.S. should not engage in offensive military action without congressional approval. The president cannot tolerate acts of terrorism against U.S. forces, but the American people cannot tolerate an unconstitutional war. Now is not the time to trust an anti-trustworthy administration, but now is exactly the time for Congress to reassert its constitutional authority. Merely receiving an intelligence briefing is not enough. The message to the Trump administration should be bipartisan and emphatic. There can be no new war without informed congressional consent. Article by David French. And moving ahead, we are now in the view at the section called The Risk Report. The headline is The EU's Far-Right Struggles to Govern by Ian Bremmer. It's a big moment for Europe's most ambitious populists. They hope that elections for the European Parliament will give them the boost they need to extend their political momentum across the EU. But in Austria, they got off to a rough start because of an embarrassing video. The details of that case are as ludicrous as they are damning. Vice Chancellor and leader of the far-right Freedom Party, Heinz Christian Strache. I'll repeat that for clarity. The details of that case are as ludicrous as they are damning. Vice Chancellor and leader of the far-right Freedom Party, Heinz Christian Strache, was caught offering lucrative government contracts to a woman he believed to be the niece of a powerful Russian oligarch in exchange for her willingness to buy an Austrian newspaper and shift its editorial position to favor his party just before an election. For many, this episode confirmed two things. Much of Europe's far right is or would like to be on the Russian payroll, and its charismatic leaders lack basic good judgment. Europe's populists are so far better at campaigning than at governing, and some of its leaders are more prone to poor judgment than their mainstream competitors. But far-right politicians haven't simply invented anti-EU, anti-migrant anger, and those who would deny them votes still struggle to answer this challenge. We now go to the milestones page. Lead item under died. I.M. Pei, modernist master. Observance by Gene Gang. Time says Gang is an architect and 2019 Time 100 honoree. She writes, most people will remember I.M. Pei for his cultural and commercial works like the Glass Pyramid at the Louvre in Paris and the Bank of China Tower in Hong Kong. But in my city, Chicago, it is residential work that remain his lasting contribution. And that helped secure his legacy as one of the most influential architects of the 20th century. In the late 1950s, Pei, who died May 16th at 102, undertook the redevelopment of a portion of the Hyde Park neighborhood in collaboration with Chicago architect Harry Weiss. This was one of the largest urban renewal projects of its time. And as with many others, discrimination and displacement are an intractable part of its story. But Pei and Weiss's design is notable for its context-sensitive approach, corresponding with Pei's interest in a better model for reshaping cities. Their plan kept viable buildings in place, renovated others, and added new ones, avoiding the complete tabula rasa of much urban renewal. Pei's modern brick townhouses with their welcoming front doors, not their garages, facing the street, sit comfortably beside older structures. And his university apartments, a pair of towers longer than they are tall, mitigate the difference in scale between old and new buildings. To visit the neighborhood today is to be reminded by Pei that modernism can adapt to its surroundings without compromising boldness or innovation. Observance by Gene Gang, I. M. Pei. This item is accompanied by a half-length full-color photograph. Caption says, Pei at the Louvre in 1993. The pyramid he designed for the museum's entrance was controversial at first, but has become a Paris landmark. In the right margin, under died, Herman Wouk, the People's Choice. Observance by Sierra Nugent. When he enlisted in the Navy after Pearl Harbor, the Bronx-born writer Herman Wouk discovered something. A life beyond the wise guys of Broadway and the wise guys of Columbia, two small worlds that sometimes take themselves for the whole world, as Time quoted him as saying in a 1955 cover story. I'll repeat that quote with quotes attributed. Quote, wise guys of Broadway and the wise guys of Columbia, two small worlds that sometimes take themselves for the whole world, unquote. The realization prompted Wouk, who died May 17th at 103, to make a change in his own life from radio gag writer to novelist. Writing for what he called the, quote, common reader, unquote, the observant Jewish author strove for realism and what he called, quote, clarity of expression, unquote. His best-known work, The Caine Mutiny, about sailors who overthrow their incompetent captain, sold more than 3 million copies in the U.S. alone and won the Pulitzer Prize for fiction in 1952. Though reviewers were lukewarm on much of the rest of his work, parenthetically more than 20 books and plays, including several bestsellers, Wouk said he put more stock in the opinion of the American public. Quote, they're good enough to elect our presidents, aren't they? Unquote. Herman Wouk, 103. This item is accompanied by a full-color rendering of a Time cover with Herman Wouk on it. Caption says, Wouk on the September 5th, 1955 cover of Time. Under Died. The internet-famous feline known as Grumpy Cat, her family said, May 17th. That item is accompanied by a photograph of Grumpy Cat. Under announced that Ford Motor Company will cut 7,000 jobs globally by the end of August, according to the carmaker on May 20th. The plan will reduce the number of salaried employees by 10%. Under ordered, an ex-Somali colonel to pay $500,000 to a victim in a 1988 torture case by a Virginia civil court on May 21st. Under revealed that Dutte Chant, India's fastest female sprinter, is in a relationship with a woman by Chand on May 19th. Revealed by Chand on May 19th. She is India's first out professional athlete. Dutte Chand. Chand is spelled C-H-A-N-D. Under introduced, Carly, a Muppet in Foster Care by Sesame Workshop, the nonprofit behind Sesame Street. Under One, that is spelled W-O-N, the Eurovision Song Contest by Duncan Lawrence of the Netherlands on May 18th at the event's finale in Tel Aviv. Under dropped, the U.S. birth rate for a fourth consecutive year. The number of people born in the U.S. in 2018 was the lowest in 32 years. Complete contents of the brief. Moving ahead, we're going to the health section of The View, where the headline is The Worldwide Threat of Generic Drugs, by Catherine Eben. Time notes Eben is the author of Bottle of Lies, the inside story of the generic drug boom, from which this essay is adapted. Bottle of Lies, the inside story of the generic drug boom. Catherine Eben. Eben is spelled E-B-A-N, and she writes, for the 16 years that Dr. Brian Westerberg, a Canadian surgeon, worked volunteer missions at the Mulago National Referral Hospital in Kampala, Uganda, scarcity was the norm. The patients usually exceeded the 1,500 allotted beds. Running water was once cut off when the hospital was unable to pay its bills. Patients often couldn't access the medication they needed. So on some early trips, Westerberg brought drugs over from Canada. But as low-cost generics made in India and China became widely available through Uganda's government and international aid agencies in the early 2000s, it seemed at first like the supply issue had been solved. Then, on February 7, 2013, Westerberg examined a feverish 13-year-old boy who had fluid oozing from an ear infection. He suspected bacterial meningitis, but couldn't confirm because the CT scanner was broken. The boy was given intravenous ceftriaxone, an antibiotic that Westerberg thought would cure him. But after 4 days, the ear was worse. As Westerberg prepared to operate, the boy had a seizure. With the CT scanner working again, Westerberg ordered a scan which revealed abscesses in the boy's skull, likely caused by the infection. When a neurosurgeon looked at the images and declared that surgery was unnecessary and the swelling and abscesses would abate with effective antibiotic treatment, Westerberg was confused. They had already treated the boy with ceftriaxone, which hadn't worked. His confusion deepened when his colleague suggested they switch to a more expensive version of the drug. Why swap one ceftriaxone for another? Most people assume that a drug is a drug, that the brand name or a generic version of it is the same anywhere in the world, so long as it's made by a reputable drug company that has been inspected and approved by regulators. That, at least, is the logic that has driven the global generic drug revolution, that drug companies in countries like India and China can produce low-cost, high-quality drugs for markets around the world. These companies have been hailed as public health heroes for giving the impoverished access to the same cures as the wealthy. But many of the generic drug companies that Americans and Africans alike depend on, which I spent a decade investigating, hold a dark secret. They adjust their manufacturing standards depending on the country buying their drugs, a practice that could endanger not just those who take the lower quality medicine, but the population at large. These companies send their highest quality drugs to markets with the most vigilant regulators, like the U.S. and the EU. They send their worst drugs, made with lower quality ingredients and less scrupulous testing, to countries with the weakest review. The U.S. drug supply is not immune to quality crises. Over the past 10 months, dozens of versions of the generic blood pressure drugs Valsartan, Losartan, and Irbesartan have been recalled. Those again, with a different pronunciation emphasis, Valsartan, Losartan, and Irbesartan. The active ingredients in some manufactured in China contained a probable carcinogen once used in the production of liquid rocket fuel. But the patients who suffer most are those in the so-called ROW markets, the generic drug industry's shorthand for, quote, rest of world, unquote. In swaths of Africa, Southeast Asia, and other areas with developing markets, some companies have made a cold calculation. They can sell their lowest quality drugs where they will be least likely to get caught. In much of Africa, for instance, pharmaceuticals used to come from more developed countries through donations and small purchases. So when Indian drug reps offering cheap generics started arriving, the initial feeling was positive. But Africa soon became an avenue, quote, to send anything at all, unquote, said Kwabena Ofori-Kwakye, an associate professor in the pharmaceutics department at the Kwame Nkrumah University of Science and Technology in Kumasi, Ghana. The poor quality has affected every type of medication, and the adverse impact on health has been, quote, astronomical, unquote, he said. Multiple doctors I spoke to throughout the continent said they have adjusted their treatments in response, sometimes tripling recommended doses. Dr. Gordon Donier, former head of the psychiatry department at the Konfo Anokye Teaching Hospital in Kumasi, treats middle-class Ghanaians in his private practice, and says that almost all the drugs his patients take are substandard, leading him to increase his patients' doses significantly. While his European colleagues typically prescribe 2.5 milligrams of haloperidol, a generic form of Halidol, several times a day to treat psychosis. He'll prescribe 10 milligrams, also several times a day, because he knows 2.5 milligrams, quote, won't do anything, unquote. Donner once gave 10 times the typical dose of diazepam, generically a generic form of Valium, to a 15-year-old boy, an amount that should have knocked him out. The patient was, quote, still smiling, unquote, Donner said. 10 times the typical dose of diazepam. Many hospitals also keep a stash of what they call fancy drugs, brand-name drugs or higher-quality generics, to treat patients who should have recovered after a round of treatment but didn't. Confronted with the boy at the Malago Hospital, Westerberg's colleagues swapped in the more expensive version of ceftriaxone and added more drugs to the treatment plan. But it was too late. In the second week of his treatment, the boy was declared brain dead. Westerberg's Ugandan colleagues were not surprised. Their patients frequently died when treated with drugs that should have saved them. And there were not enough fancy drugs to go around, making every day an exercise in triage. It was also hard to keep track of which generics were not to be trusted, said one doctor in Western Uganda. Quote, it's anesthesia today, ceftriaxone tomorrow, amoxicillin the next day, unquote. Westerberg flew back to Canada and teamed up with Jason Nickerson, a respiratory therapist who had had similar experiences with bad medicine in Ghana. They decided to test the chemical properties of the generic ceftriaxone that had been implicated in the Ugandan boy's death. Another of Westerberg's colleagues brought him a vial from the Malago Hospital pharmacy. The drug had been made by a manufacturer in northern China, which also exported to the U.S. and other developed markets. When they tested it at Nickerson's lab, it contained less than half the active drug ingredient stated on the label. At such low concentration, the drug was basically useless, Nickerson said. He and Westerberg established a case report in the CDC's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. Although they couldn't say with certainty that the boy had died because of substandard ceftriaxone, their report offered compelling evidence that he had. Some companies claim that while their drugs are all high quality, there may be some variance in how they are produced because regulations differ from market to market. But Patrick H. Lucalay, former vice president of Global Health Impact Programs for USP, parenthetically formerly U.S. Pharmacopeia, one of the world's top pharmaceutical standard-setting organizations, calls that argument, quote, totally garbage, unquote. For any given drug, he says, quote, there's only one standard, and that standard was set by the originator, unquote, meaning the brand name company that developed the product. There is more to this article, but this is a double issue, so in the interest of getting more material in, we go right to the cover story. Under the general heading, World Cup 2019, the headline is, Alex Morgan Strikes Again. The soccer star is primed to lead the U.S. to victory on and off the field by Sean Gregory. And your reader must correct the headline. It's Alex Morgan Strikes Back. And moving ahead, we are in page one of the article. On a drizzly spring evening in New York City, Alex Morgan fixes her gaze on the golf ball at her feet, cocks her arms, and then propels them forward with effortless power. The ball leaps off the tee and sails toward the netting between the tee and the Hudson River, 200 yards away. Quote, "This is nice," unquote, Morgan says, exhaling between swings. Quote, "Really nice," unquote. The driving range is a favorite escape for Morgan, but she's spending less and less time there, even as she needs a release more than ever. The reigning U.S. Women's Soccer Player of the Year, Morgan is the sport's most marketable American star since Mia Hamm, and the linchpin of Team USA's bid to clinch a second consecutive World Cup title this summer. She leads the U.S. into the tournament, which begins on June 7 in France, facing outsized expectations both on the field and off. As the defending champions and top-ranked team, the Americans are favored to win. But the competition is historically tough. When the U.S. hosted the landmark 1999 World Cup, which led tens of thousands of girls to sign up for youth soccer leagues, only a few countries were considered contenders. Traditional soccer powers like France, England, and Spain didn't even qualify. Now, thanks in part to increased investment from soccer governing bodies and their corporate backers, many more have a real shot in the tournament, which now has 24 teams, up from 16 two decades ago. Quote, "This is the first time I have ever been able to name potential winners on more than one hand," unquote, says former U.S. player Julie Foudy, an ESPN analyst, who sees the U.S., France, Germany, Australia, Japan, England, and Sweden as title threats. Quote, "Absolutely, this is the most competitive World Cup I have seen," unquote. Interest should be particularly high in the U.S., where the women's team not only outperforms the men's team on the field, the men fail to even qualify for last year's World Cup, but has outdrawn it, too. 4 years ago, some 25 million people watched the women's team beat Japan in the World Cup final, a second U.S. audience, a record U.S. audience for any soccer game, 25 million. But the team's success highlights glaring inequities. Despite the popularity of the women's team, the men are positioned to make substantially more money. And so, on March 8th, International Women's Day, the U.S. players took the unprecedented step of filing a federal gender discrimination lawsuit against the United States Soccer Federation, the national governing body for the sport. Morgan's name was listed first in the suit, which accuses U.S. soccer of paying, quote, "only lip service to gender equality," unquote. Parenthetically, the federation, in a legal filing responding to the complaint, denied unlawful conduct, attributing any alleged pay discrepancies to, quote, "differences in the aggregate revenue generated by the different teams and or any other factor other than sex," unquote. End of parentheses. Quote, "Eventually, you just have to take a stand," unquote, Morgan says, while riding in an Uber from her New York hotel to the driving range. Quote, "How come we've had to fight this whole time, year after year," unquote. Her stand has inspired other women's teams around the world to push for equal treatment and has transformed the U.S. women into a cause larger than soccer. At the Los Angeles exhibition game in April, actors Jessica Chastain, Eva Longoria, Jennifer Garner, Uzo Aduba, and Natalie Portman attended with T-shirts that read, quote, "Time's up, pay up." I'll repeat that for clarity with apologies. T-shirts that read, "Time's up, pay up," that's in all caps. At a time of almost paralyzing political division, the World Cup has the potential to be a welcome national distraction, a respite from presidential politics ticking and cable news sniping. Quote, a win for this team is a win for women everywhere, unquote, says former U.S. captain Abby Wambaugh. Quote, if other women in the business world, in parenting, see these women stepping up and betting on themselves, it gives them the power to want to do it for themselves. And that, my friend, is how the world actually changes, unquote. No pressure or anything, not that Morgan wasn't feeling plenty already. Morgan, 29, is the face of Team USA. Her steely gaze will be plastered on billboards and dancing across screens in commercials for Coca-Cola, Nike, and Secret deodorant. Her millions of followers on Instagram and Twitter give her one of the largest social media imprints of any female athlete in the world. She starred in a Nickelodeon movie for kids, Alex and Me, wrote a series of books for middle schoolers that was made into an Amazon TV series, and has shared a stage with Taylor Swift. But Morgan, who in April joined Ham and Wambaugh as the youngest U.S. players to score 100 career international goals, has never dominated the World Cup. She was a breakout rookie in a losing effort in 2011 and was hobbled by injuries in 2015 when Carly Lloyd's heroics powered the U.S. to victory. This year is the best chance for America's best player to make her mark on the world's most prestigious tournament while showing that she should be paid the same as any man for doing it. Quote, we have to do more in general. We have to be the athlete. We have to be the role model. We have to lead the way for the next generation, unquote, Morgan says. Quote, are male athletes doing that? Are they thinking about anyone other than themselves? I don't know. We do have more than one job within this role and are getting paid much less, unquote. So it's understandable if the weight of it all weighs on Morgan as she hacks away at the driving range. After a few crisp swings, she whiffs, missing the ball completely. Quote, I'm going back to my 7-iron, unquote, she says, when her driver catches air. All that looms in the background is national unity, gender equality, and Morgan's professional legacy. Quote, you can't think about it, but you can't not, unquote. Leading the fight for equal pay in sports was far from the mind of the 8-year-old Morgan when she left a post-it for her mother, Pam, at their home in Diamond Bar, California, a suburb east of Los Angeles. Quote, hi, Mommy, unquote, Morgan wrote on a note Pam still has. Quote, my name is Alex, and I am going to be a professional athlete for soccer, unquote. She signed it, quote, Ali Cat. That's spelled A-L-I and then C-A-T. She signed it, Ali Cat. The certainty was surprising. Unlike most promising young soccer players, Morgan avoided the high-pressure Southern California youth circuit and played many different sports as a kid. Her competitiveness was honed in fierce board games with her parents and two older sisters. Alex, quote, Alex strove not to be the loser, unquote, says her father, Michael, a retired attorney, a retired masonry contractor. Michael, a retired masonry contractor, quote, because she knew she was going to get party danced around, unquote. Morgan began playing elite travel soccer at 14, years after many of her contemporaries. She credits playing a range of sports with preventing her from burning out. Quote, when I went to soccer practice, I was really excited because I hadn't been there in 4 days, unquote, says Morgan. She worries that today's youth system is also pricing out potential soccer stars and is counterproductive to America's future competitiveness. Morgan's speed and knack for scoring earned her a soccer scholarship to the University of California, Berkeley, where she graduated with a degree in political economy and met her future husband, Los Angeles Galaxy midfielder Servando Carrasco, who also played for the school. Morgan excelled on the pitch for Cal and was named the U.S. under-20 team, which functions as a feeder for the top national team. After helping lead the U.S. to the 2008 under-20 World Cup title with a brilliant left-footed goal in the final, Morgan was called up to the senior squad. Her impact was immediate. Morgan scored a key goal against Italy to help the U.S. qualify for the 2011 World Cup, and she emerged as a go-to substitute in the tournament. Undaunted by soccer's biggest stage, Morgan scored in both the semis and the finals in her first World Cup, which the U.S. lost in heartbreaking fashion to Japan. The performance endeared Morgan to her older teammates. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time. I hope you've enjoyed it. This was a double issue. Please be sure to listen next time or replay this one. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. That's TriangleReadingService.org. This is Randall Rickman reading for Triangle Radio Reading Service. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time, and we look forward to you being with us for your Time magazine.